Good morning. It's great to see everyone. I hope you had a lovely Thanksgiving, even if it was a little different to most years, or a lot different. As you know, today is the first Sunday in Advent. Pretty much every year, the start of Advent takes me by surprise. It always seems way too early, and I'm not at all ready for it. But this being 2020, I'm actually anxious to get this started. Let's bring it on. Let's have Christmas and a new year and all that that brings, hopefully including the rollout of a vaccine. It's only November, but I think I'm actually ready for spring. For me, at least, I think it would be very easy to zoom through Advent, no pun intended there, to rush through Advent on the way to everything beyond it. But Advent, like Lent, is a gift. It's an opportunity not to speed up, but to actually slow down, to reflect, to think about what matters to us, where we are in our lives, where we'd like to be, whether we're ready for another Christmas and New Year. And we're going to do that this year by following the story of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. I'm sure that's a book and or a movie that is familiar to most of us, but in case you need a quick reminder, it's the story of a guy named Ebenezer Scrooge, who is mean and miserly and totally lacking in empathy and compassion. He hates Christmas. He thinks it's just an excuse to slack off from work, and he lives estranged from his family, unloved and unhappy. On Christmas Eve night, his deceased business partner, Jacob Marley, visits Scrooge to warn him that he needs to change his ways. Marley, like Scrooge, was also greedy and selfish, and as punishment, he spent the last 7 years as a ghost roaming the world in heavy chains. So Marley tells Scrooge he's going to be visited that night by three spirits, and he should listen to them and change his ways unless he too wants to face the same fate. Scrooge is indeed visited by three spirits, the spirit of Christmas past, spirit of Christmas present, and spirit of Christmas yet to come. And then he wakes up to Christmas morning. So for the 4 weeks of Advent, we're going to follow this same order, looking at past, present, and future, and ending with a celebration of Christmas. A Christmas Carol was written in 1843 and was an instant classic. It was published on December 19th of that year and had completely sold out by Christmas Eve. 12 more editions were published in the following year alone. The first movie version was released in 1910, created by Thomas Edison's film production company. And there have been many, many other movie versions, as well as theatrical productions, puppet shows, even operas based on the story. In fact, you might want to reread the book or watch one of the movies to engage with this story a little more during this Advent season. But just what is the appeal of this story? Well, I'm sure everyone has their own reasons for liking it, but there are two aspects of this story that stand out to me. And the first is its weightiness in what can be a rather frivolous season. This is not a story about elves or gingerbread houses or anything like that. This is a book about life and death, about how life impacts death in Marley's case, and more central to the story, how, like Scrooge, you can still be alive but really be already dead, or at least mostly dead, to quote another movie, when you should and you could be living life more fully. It's a movie about identity and character and how who we are impacts the people around us. The visions of past, present, and future are forced on Scrooge. He doesn't want to go there. It's quite an unsettling story, even scary. In fact, many kids have been traumatized by this story over the years. But at the same time, it's also a very hopeful story. The central theme is that change is possible. It's never too late to change, and change for the better. Despite appearances, Scrooge is not a hopeless case, and in fact, perhaps even change is easier than we imagine it to be. Now, of course, this is a story. I don't think many people are transformed overnight, but the message is change is possible and change is worth it. I hope I'm not spoiling the ending for anyone by saying that for Scrooge, change proves to be worth it, worth the fear and the pain. So this is a great story for Advent, for this season when we reflect on who and where we are in life and as we look to God to help us change for the better. The word Advent comes from the Latin word adventus, meaning coming or arrival, and originally it referred almost exclusively to the arrival of a Caesar. So the word carries with it a sense of movement as well as a sense of anticipation. And like the three spirits in A Christmas Carol, Advent has traditionally had three dimensions: past, present, and future. The past dimension refers to the words of the prophets in the Jewish scriptures. Churches that follow a traditional liturgy have a strong focus at this time of year on prophets like Isaiah, Zechariah, Malachi, and others. Prophets who brought promises of God's help to people. Promises that God hadn't forgotten them, that God was with them, God would lead them into a more secure and peaceful future. These promises of rescue and comfort and hope related to specific events in the life of the prophets, hundreds of years before Jesus was born. But over time, they were also seen as referring to some future day when God would step into time and space in an unprecedented way by sending a Messiah to save Israel and restore justice and peace to the world. And so, as followers of Jesus, we see this past dimension of Advent fulfilled in the life of Jesus. The present dimension refers to the belief that this is not just a historical story or even a myth from a long time ago, but that Jesus is here with us today by his Spirit in the midst of the joys and the struggles of everyday life. And that Jesus' presence with us means something. It gives us the power to change. It gives us the hope to believe that change is possible. And the future dimension refers to our hope in the many promises in scripture that God will reconcile all things. Now that could mean all kinds of things, and we'll look at some of what that might mean in week three. But whatever the specifics, we believe we can be hopeful for the future. God promises not to abandon creation, but to make it whole and to make us whole. So this is hope that Jesus's future advent, Jesus's future coming, will be in a whole new way. It will be an answer to the prayer, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So, sorry, although it's a bit of a cliche to say it, I think Advent is a magical time of year. It's a break with ordinary time, and it's a unique season in the year when past, present, and future converge in some ways. So this week we're going to look at Christmas past, and we're going to watch a clip from Disney's A Christmas Carol. Now, just before this clip starts, the spirit of Christmas past appears to Scrooge as he's sleeping in bed and carries him off to see scenes from his childhood. Now, in the book, the spirit of Christmas past makes the statement that time is running out for Scrooge. And this is illustrated in this version of the movie by the spirit being a small stub of candle that is rapidly burning away. In the scenes from Scrooge's past, we see he was a poor child with an abusive father who sent him away from home at a young age to fend for himself. It's all very sad. And in this scene we're going to watch, Ebenezer Scrooge is looking at a younger version of himself dancing on Christmas Eve with the love of his life and future fiancée, Belle. Let's watch it. Poor Scrooge. He was so full of fear of becoming poor and vulnerable again, as he had been as a child, that he became obsessed with making money and drove away the people who loved him. And now, looking back, he's full of regret. Regret is perhaps not an uncommon response when we look back over our lives, maybe particularly actually at the holidays. There's an expectation in our culture that everything should just be wonderful at the holidays. And when we look back, life might not quite live up to that. Maybe when we look back, we have regrets about some of the decisions we've made, or opportunities we didn't take, or relationships we let fall by the wayside. And so often, as with Scrooge, we can see these decisions were based on fear, fear of loss or vulnerability, fear of being hurt or disappointed. I don't know anyone who's quite like Scrooge, but maybe some of those regrets have made many of us a little bit hard or cynical, or bitter even. And maybe, like Scrooge, we'd really rather not reflect on the past at all. But the past need not only engender regret. The past can also be a source of hope. Scrooge looks back on his relationship with Belle with regret. But as the viewer or the reader, we get a different perspective on Scrooge. We see him in a new light. We realize he wasn't always as he is now. And if he wasn't always bitter and mean in the past, well, maybe he won't always be bitter and mean in the future. Looking back might show us that there is reason for hope. Hope that things can be different. Hope that we can be different. Scrooge doesn't want to look at his past. He lives in fear. But these visions are a gift, an unwelcome gift, but a gift nonetheless. They're a gift of hope for a new way of living. Will Scrooge continue to live in fear, or will he choose to live in hope? We'll have to see as the story goes on. But this choice between living in fear and living in hope was one that the Jewish nation was very aware of throughout their history. Time and again, we read in the Bible stories, the Jewish people came under attack, or they were oppressed, or faced with other kinds of hardship. And time and again, they had to choose between living in fear and protecting themselves at all costs, the way Scrooge did with his wealth, or living in hope and trusting in God's protection. And it's at those decisive moments, choosing between hope and fear, that the prophets spoke out. And we're going to look at some traditional Advent passages from the prophets today. There are lots of ancient prophetic scriptures that have become associated with the birth of Jesus. But each of these scriptures has its own story. The prophets spoke into specific contexts. They addressed current dangers and hardships, such as the imminent invasion by a foreign power, or a famine, or the loss of identity following forced exile, and so on. But as we mentioned earlier, ancient Jewish scholars saw some of the words of the prophets as also having a future fulfillment in the coming of the Messiah. And in addition, there were prophetic passages that were not commonly associated with the Messiah, but the writers of the Gospels saw in them links to events in Jesus' life. So for example, we read in Matthew chapter 2, just after the story of the Magi coming to visit Jesus, we read this. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Now this quote, "out of Egypt I call my son," is taken from the writings of the prophet Hosea. Hosea wasn't talking about the Messiah. The son refers to Israel. God led Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And the writer of Matthew's gospel knows that. He's not claiming Hosea meant by the statement that Jesus would flee to Egypt. But rather he's saying, look, here's another story from the history of the Jewish people that links to the story of Jesus. Just like Israel came out of Egypt, so did Jesus. It's like a foreshadowing. The writer of Matthew's gospel isn't saying this proves that Jesus is the Messiah and that Hosea prophesied about him. He's saying Jesus continues and fulfills the story of our Jewish community. So as we mentioned, there are loads of scriptures that have become associated with the birth and life of Jesus, interpreted that way either by the rabbis or by the gospel writers. And we're not going to try and look at all of them. That would be crazy. We're going to restrict our view this morning to three passages in the first few chapters of Isaiah. And the first of these is in Isaiah chapter 7, where we read, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and we'll call him Emmanuel." I'm sure that sounds familiar to many of us, right? It's one of those verses you often get printed on a Christmas card. But let's look at it in its original context. The year is somewhere around 730 BCE. The old kingdom of Israel had split in two about 200 years previously. The large northern part retained the name Israel and made Samaria its capital. And the small southern part, which included Jerusalem, became the kingdom of Judah. And at the time of this passage in Isaiah 7, the kingdom of Judah was being attacked by Israel and Aram for refusing to join an alliance to fight the powerful Assyrian Empire. The king of Judah, called Ahaz, was very scared, and he decided to reach out to Assyria for help against Israel and Aram. And the prophet Isaiah came along and said, "Bad idea. Assyria is not your friend at all. But don't worry about Israel and Aram. God will protect you and they will be destroyed." Now, King Ahaz was not convinced by this. So God offered to give Ahaz a sign. We read, "Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights." But Ahaz said, "I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test." Then Isaiah said, "Hear now, you house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of humans? Will you try the patience of my God also?" Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel. He will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. So the sign was that a boy would be born to a specific young woman, and before that boy was old enough to know right from wrong, Israel and Aram would be destroyed. We don't know who this woman was, but Isaiah calls her the woman, so it seems to be a specific person that he has in mind who is not named. Now, in the version we just read, of course, and on most Christmas cards, it doesn't read woman, it reads virgin. The book of Isaiah was written in Hebrew, and in Hebrew the word is Alma, which means a young woman of childbearing age who has not yet given birth. But when the Jewish scriptures were translated into Greek in the 2nd century BCE, the word was translated as Parthenos, which usually means virgin, although it also can mean a young, newly wedded woman. So in neither case does it necessarily mean virgin. But Isaiah is saying to King Ahaz, this young woman here will have a son called Emmanuel, which means God is with us. And long before he reaches adulthood, Israel and Aram will be destroyed. So don't be afraid. As you see this woman getting bigger in her pregnancy, and as you watch her baby grow, let this be a tangible reminder to you that God is with you. You don't need to run after Assyria for protection. God will take care of you. And in fact, we know that in the year 722 BCE, Assyria marched into Samaria and went on to destroy Israel completely. So this prophecy was fulfilled in its original context within about 10 years. But the writer of Matthew's Gospel sees in the scripture a foreshadowing of Jesus' birth to a virgin, namely Mary. He sees the prophecy being fulfilled in a way that almost certainly was not what Isaiah was intending to communicate at the time. But the connection to Jesus, in hindsight, is clear, not only through reading this as a reference to a virgin birth, but also through the sign of a baby boy indicating God's presence with us. Unlike the child Isaiah was referring to in the context of the 8th century BCE, Jesus is not just a reminder of Emmanuel, of God with us. Jesus is Emmanuel. We don't need to fear. We don't need to look elsewhere for protection, for God is with us. Let's look at a second passage in Isaiah. It's just a couple of chapters later. We read in Isaiah chapter 9, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." Again, probably familiar words to many of us from Christmas services through the years. But what did these words mean in the 8th century BCE? Well, originally Isaiah was prophesying about Hezekiah, King Ahaz's son. If you read Jewish commentaries on this passage, they will say that the name ascribed to Hezekiah, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, is not meant to be a description of Hezekiah himself, but indicates how God's character and God's faithfulness will be demonstrated in Hezekiah's life. And there are events in Hezekiah's life that illustrate these points. So, for example, in the year 701 BCE, Assyria laid siege to Jerusalem. So we see Isaiah was right. Assyria was not a friend of Judah. And Hezekiah is put in the same position that his father Ahaz had been in previously, you know, about 30 years before. With Assyria on the attack this time instead of Israel and Aram, the obvious political solution was to call on Egypt for help. But Hezekiah didn't do that. Unlike his father Ahaz, Hezekiah listened to the prophets and instead prayed to God for help. And according to the accounts in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, something strange happened one night and thousands of the Assyrian camp leaders were found dead in the morning, covered in blood. And the writers of Second Chronicles and Second Kings describe it as the work of an angel of the Lord. And then the siege was over. The army withdrew, thus demonstrating that God is indeed a mighty God. Later in his life, Hezekiah became very ill with some kind of tumors and was expected to die. And again, he prayed to God, asking God this time to extend his life. And God, the Eternal Father, added 15 years to Hezekiah's life. And the remainder of Hezekiah's reign was peaceful. And archaeological records show that settlements in the area increased significantly during this time. Settlers, particularly those displaced from the former northern kingdom of Israel, sought a safe and peaceful place to live and moved in to Judah. So we have a Prince of Peace demonstrating the greatness of God's government. Isaiah's prophetic words in chapter 9 seem to find at least partial fulfillment in Hezekiah. Hezekiah was considered a righteous king. He enacted sweeping religious reforms and outlawed the worship of foreign gods. But he was also flawed. He grew proud and he boasted of his riches. He seemed indifferent to future threats to his people. He didn't really live up to this description of God's character and faithfulness that we see in his name. And so this passage becomes one of those that was associated in Jewish thought with the coming of the Messiah, a future king who would bring lasting peace, justice, and righteousness. We see that even more in Isaiah chapter 11, where Isaiah presents what life might be like under such a future king. And this is the last of the prophecies we're going to look at today. Isaiah 11. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. Isaiah had high hopes for Hezekiah, as we've seen, but it seems very unlikely that he thought Hezekiah could ever fulfill these words. Isaiah is looking forward to a completely different kind of king. Even allowing for poetic hyperbole, this is a king like David, who's rooted in the line of Jesse, but so much better than even Israel's greatest king. This king will bring justice for the poor of the whole earth. This king will not just defeat enemies, but he will bring peace to all nations. This is the promise of a whole new world order, a new way of being. This certainly wasn't accomplished under Hezekiah's reign. Hezekiah at one point invited people from the tribes in the former northern kingdom to join the Passover celebration in Jerusalem, but they refused to come. He couldn't reunite Israel, let alone bring peace to all the nations. His reforms were short-lived. Idolatry and violence returned with a vengeance during the reign of his son Manasseh, who served as a puppet king for Assyria. There was no lasting peace. No lasting justice. The writings in the long book of Isaiah span many decades and cover at least four, if not five, kings of Judah, each of them falling hopelessly short of this vision presented in chapter 11. I think if I'd been in Israel, in Isaiah's place, I would have become rather cynical. Time after time, the king failed to live up to his calling. But Isaiah doesn't seem to have become cynical. He maintains a hope throughout the book that one day God will send another kind of king, God's chosen one, God's Messiah. The gospel writers saw these hopes fulfilled in Jesus, although of course not as expected. Jesus' kingship was altogether different. He didn't sit on a throne and command audiences. He lay in a manger. He touched lepers. He washed people's feet. And ultimately, he laid down his life for that new world order, for a new way of being. So what are we to make of all this? How can we apply it to our own lives this week? Well, first, perhaps we can ask ourselves, how do we feel when we look back on our own story? Do we, like Scrooge, regret some of the decisions we've made? Perhaps we've not always chosen the loving response. Perhaps we've allowed certain relationships to sour or to just fade away. Perhaps we're not who we hoped we would be, who we would like to be. What will be our response to any regrets we feel? Scrooge responded with fear. He wanted to just avoid thinking about it. He wanted to get out of there, to put out that little wick of a spirit. One way to avoid thinking about regrets from our past is to distract ourselves. And the lead up to Christmas is full of distractions. So let's just not reflect. Let's get busy with other things. Like King Ahaz, rather than turning to God, maybe we can look elsewhere for help and comfort and protection from our fears. Or maybe we'll respond with cynicism. Scrooge was also quite cynical. When Bell pointed out that he showed an altered disposition, Scrooge claimed he was just wiser. He came to understand the world. He was just taking care of himself. Or maybe like Manasseh, Hezekiah's son, becoming a loyal vassal to Assyria. Maybe it's just a case of, you know, you do what you've got to do to get by. These are all responses that come from fear. But in the Christmas nativity stories, we hear time and again the words, fear not. So maybe like Ahaz before us, we can see the birth of a baby boy as a sign that God is with us. God is for us. We don't need to live in fear. Maybe as we reflect back on our lives, we can respond not with fear, but with hope. Hope that change is possible. The prophets, not just Isaiah, but Zechariah, Jeremiah, Hosea, and a whole bunch of others repeated the promise that one day God would step in and send a Messiah. One day there would be a whole different way of being. Peace and justice, shalom, well-being is possible. And this hope is not an arrogant hope. It's not saying we've got all the answers and God's going to step in and vindicate us and show everybody we're right. And this is not a hope that says, oh, nothing bad can ever happen to us because God is on our side. Rather, this is a hope in God's presence with us, God's presence within us, enabling us to change. This hope can be fragile. It can be hard to hope when the enemy armies are threatening to destroy you. It can be hard to hope when you feel alone and anxious. Hope can be a shadowy thing, like a single candle in the darkness. At the same time, hope is not passive, it's active. The prophets often use the present tense to describe the future. Isaiah wrote, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned." It's now, not somewhere far off in the future. The challenge is to step into that hope, to live it, to embody it, even in the midst of the darkness. We're going to light a candle of hope right now, and Anna's going to lead us in that.